This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، أفضل الصلوات وتم التسليمات على مبعوث رحمة للعالمين سيدنا محمد النبي الأمي وعلى آله وأصحابه ومن اهتدى بهديه واستنى بسنته إلى يوم الدين. So we are reading from the book تدريب السالك إلى قراءة أقرب المسالك في مذهب الإمام مالك in مالكي فقه مالكي jurisprudence. And we have arrived at the bab or the chapter dealing with the adhan and the iqama. So in our last session, we had begun to look at aspects of the prayer after we had concluded tahara or ritual purity. And last session, we talked about wukut al-salah or awqat al-salah, the timings of the prayers. And the next natural or logical step when we think about the ritual prayer or salah is al-a'lan anha, which is to the manner by which we announce the prayer. And there's two basic sort of announcements that are made in Islam. One is an initial one called the adhan, which is the one that is generally used to bring people who may be from close by areas to come and join the congregational prayer. And then the iqama, which tells you, or that informs people, that the prayer is imminent at that particular point. And this was something that the Prophet Muhammad SAW himself instituted when he established the ritual prayer in Al-Madinah Al-Munawwara ala sahibiha afdal salatu wassalam. And he had certain assigned people to be the muazzinun, or those who would call the adhan, namely Sayyidina Bilal ibn Rabah Al-Habashi and Abdullah ibn Abi Maktoum radiallahu anhuma. So they would alternate as the muadhinun depending upon availability in Al-Madinah Al-Munawwara. So this chapter bab fil adhan wal iqama qala al-musannif rahimahullah radiallahu anhu wa ankum wa nafa'a lana bi dhulmi fid dharain amin. Al-adhan huwa a'lamun bi dukhul al-waqt. So he defines what the adhan is, and this is actually the style of Imam al-Dardir, as we will see. He likes to define everything in the beginning, and many of the authors before him sort of depended upon another book for definitions, namely Hudud ibn Arafah, al-Tunisi. But Imam al-Dardir had some slight modifications in some of his definitions. Since he was also a logician, and he was min ulama al-Kalam, or Islamic theology, so he liked to be very precise in his definitions. These, some of them are adopted more or less from Imam al-Dardir's definitions. So he says, al-adhan huwa a'lamun bidukhul al-waqt. So the adhan is an a'lam, it's an announcement that the prayer time has commenced. Wa yajibu fi kulli qaryah. Now he's talking about its hukum, or its ruling, and he said it is obligatory in every town. Fi kulli qaryah. What type of obligation? We would say fard kifaya, right? Because he didn't say yajibu ala kulli mukallaf. He said yajibu fi kulli qariya. So every town where there is a settlement, where Muslims are living, and one of the things that is a fard kifaya is that they have to establish a place of prayer. And this was one of the very first thing that the Prophet ﷺ actually did in Al-Madinah. After settling where he was going to settle, he established a place of prayer, the masjid. So the adhan then should be called at least within earshot of the people who would be able to pray within that particular place. So he says qarya, he didn't even say medina. Qarya even means small town or village. So as long as it has a number of inhabitants who can come and gather to pray, then the adhan should be called in that particular place. وَيُسَنُّ فِي كُلِّ مَسْجِدْ وَلِجَمَاعَةٍ تَطْلُبُ غَيْرَهَا. And it's also sunnah, a strong sunnah, that every mosque, every masjid, should have its adhan, its own adhan. وَلِجَمَاعَةٍ تَطْلُبُ غَيْرَهَا. or for a group of people who are calling or seeking others to join them in the congregational prayer. So that means it doesn't necessarily have to be in a masjid. It could be in a room in a university. It could be out in the open somewhere where people, Muslims may be around, and you want to call the adhan so that others may come and join to join the congregational prayer. So it's a strong sunnah in every masjid for the adhan to be called. So we know it's wajib, fard kifaya, for a town, settlement, no matter how large or small it is. And it's a strong sunnah in every mosque, and for a group of people who are seeking others to join them. وَيُنْدَبُ لَهَا إِنْ لَمْ تَطْلُبْ غَيْرَهَا فِي السَّفَرِ وَخَارَجِ الْبَلَدِ كَالْمُنْفَرِدِ. And then it's recommended. So in the madhab, we have something called al-mandub or al-mustahab, which means not in the strongest level of recommendation, like what we call sunnah, but something less than that, nevertheless recommended. يُنْدَبُ لَهَا إِلَّمْ تَطْلُبُ غَيْرَهَا فِي السَّفَرْ وَخَارَجِ الْبَلَدِ. And it's recommended if one is traveling and or outside of their town where they live, like someone who's alone, somewhere out in the open, for that person to also call the adhan. Then the question comes, well, how come? Because if they're not expecting anyone else to join them, who is going to join them? Well, the answer to that is that the malaika are going to join them. The angels will join them. There's a hadith of the Prophet ﷺ, narrated in more than one of the sahih, that someone who calls the adhan fil falat, which is an open area or out by themselves, if they call the adhan, and they call the iqama, and then they pray, that then they will have angels behind them and in front of them and joining them in the prayer, inshaAllah. هذا في السفر وخارج البلد كالمنفرد. ويكره لهما في البلد. But it is disliked to call the adhan if you're not traveling, if you're not at a masjid, and you don't expect another group to join you, and you're in town or at home, then it would be disliked to call the adhan at that point. So like if you're getting together with a group of friends and you're at somebody's house, and this is where you actually live, and you don't expect another group to join you, then you can call the adhan, but in the Maliki school, it would be disliked to do so, because it's not serving its purpose, which is to call others, whether they are actual human beings, or they're the malaik. So that's how they interpret it. So also for the munfarid, someone who is alone and praying individually, if they are home, then they should not call the adhan, they should only call the aqama, as we'll get to when we get to that section. ويحرم قبل دخول الوقت إلا الصبح فيندب في ثلث الليل الآخر ويعاد بعد طلوع الفجر وهل السنة الأول أو الثاني قولا ويحرم قبل دخول الوقت إلا الصبح. And it is impermissible, haram, to call the adhan before actual time comes in, except for the subah prayer or the morning prayer. This was the practice of the Prophet ﷺ, that one of the two ma'adhan, Ibn Abi Maktum or Bilal, would call the adhan, the first adhan, which would be prior to the actual subah prayer, the morning prayer, and then one after the time has come in. Why this prayer specifically? Because it's actually waking people up from sleep. And as a result, there would be two adhans. Otherwise, none of the other prayers are you going to call the adhan before the time actually comes in. So when is the preferred time for the first adhan of the morning prayer before the time actually comes in? He says, فَيُنْدَبُوا فِي السُّدَسِ اللَّيْلِ الْآخِرِ. So in the last sixth of the night, sometime during that time, which usually is not going to be more than half an hour, 40 minutes, before the actual commencement of the Fajr prayer, the Subah prayer, is when it's recommended to do so. وَيُعَادُوا بعد طلوع الفجر. And then it's sunnah to repeat it after Fajr actually comes in, so people know that now the time has come in. وهل السنة الأول أو الثاني قولان. And is the sunnah, right, the more recommended one, the stronger sunnah, the first one or the second? Two opinions, but the stronger opinion is the second one is the sunnah, because it comes in after the prayer time actually commences, whereas the first adhan is recommended. That's why I said for يندب على أساس أنه مندوب. ويجوز تعدده, and it's permissible to have more than one أذان or one مؤذن or more than one أذان at a time from the same masjid. In other words, they can be done in succession as long as the time has come in. And they even said it's permissible to have more than one مؤذن if they alternate in saying the siga or the formula of the adhan, as long as there's no taqti'a. They said taqti'a of lafz al-jalala, of Allah's name. So the ta'addud, to having more than one adhan in the same place or in the same qarya, in the same town, is permissible. And it's also permissible to have some sort of, he doesn't say it here, but it's also permissible to have some sort of tertib or structure to that. So if, you know, if a municipality decides that within a 3 or 4 mile radius where the loudspeakers can be heard, that there'll only be one adhan and not not an adhan at the same time from each masjid, then that's something up to them. But certainly it doesn't remove the hukum, the ruling that every masjid should have an adhan. Whether they put it on the loudspeaker or not, that's another issue. وَشُرُوتُ الْمُؤَذِّنِ. Now we're coming to the conditions of the mu'adhin, and these are going to be shurut siha. So for the adhan to be valid, what are the conditions that we need in the mu'adhin, the one who's actually calling the adhan? One, Islam, that they should be Muslim, not a non-Muslim. Waql, that they be of sound intellect, so not someone who's considered clinically insane. Wadhukura, and they should be male, not female. I did look into this a little bit. The Maliki school does have a dissenting opinion that says it's makruh, or dislike, for a woman to call the adhan, but not haram. And they base this on the fact that women were scholars and they were narrators of hadith, and so they don't subscribe to the opinion that the sawt al-mar'a awra, that the mere voice of a woman is awra, is something that should not be heard. And of course, you know, I think that also depends upon, you know, case-by-case basis and a particular cultural context of where this is being done. We don't normally have women call the adhan. Certainly, if they're in a group by themselves, they can do that. But in terms of calling adhan from a masjid, it hasn't something that's been really been practiced. And generally speaking, it's going to be males who will call the adhan. Though there's nothing intrinsic about being a female that would permit her not to do it, as we understand. وَبُلُوغ. So bulugh, to be of post-pubescent. Unless, they said, if a young boy calls the adhan, then they have been told by someone who is baligh, someone who is an adult, that the time has come in. Then they could call the adhan. But generally speaking, it should be someone who is an adult, not a child. So بلوغ أو اعتماد على أذان بالغ أو أمري, which is he says here. So either they be post-pubescent or they're dependent upon someone who is, or the command, who understands the prayer times. Because traditionally the مؤذن wasn't just someone who calls the أذان, they were also the timekeeper. And before we had these kind of calculations based upon calendars, there were actually people who had a system for determining the prayer times using shadows and times of days and things like this. So it was kind of a more involved task than just reading off a calendar or looking at your phone and seeing if the time has come in or not. So it did require a certain skill. And this person, we call them a waqit, someone who knows the tawqit, who can measure the tawqit and know when the prayer time comes in. وَيُنْدَبُ قَوْنُهُ مُتَطَهِّرًا صَيِّتًا فِي مَحَلٍ مُرْتَفَعٍ. And it's recommended for this person, the mu'adhin, to be mutatahir, in other words, be in a state of wudu. It's not a requirement, but it's recommended. Sayyitan means min as-sawt, to have a good voice, or a loud voice, or not necessarily a melodious voice, but a voice that is not cacophony to people's ears. Someone whose voice, you know, will bring them closer to the prayer and not push them away. The Maliki scholars in general didn't like a very melodious adhan, as we hear in some countries. If you go to some countries where the Maliki school is dominant, like Morocco, Mauritania, you don't hear a very melodious type of adhan, like you might hear in Egypt or in Turkey. But nonetheless, they said it's that type of thing is permissible, but not to the extent where it becomes something that they would deem to be inappropriate for a call to prayer. Allahu a'lam. But they said sayyitan, which means has a good voice. في محل مرتفع. Which is to have a raised place. And that's really what the minarets were for to begin with. And a minaret in Arabic is called a mi'dana, right? Place of adhan, or the tool, the building that's used to call the adhan. So you find in many traditional masajid that were built centuries ago, there's kind of a spiral staircase usually that will take you all the way up to the mi'dana to call the prayer. I actually went up one of them in Azhar in Egypt, and by the time I got up there, I was dizzy. And I couldn't imagine a person going five times down and back and forth, but that's what they used to do, to call the adhan. So it's makan murtafa, so that the sound can propagate. Now, obviously, we live in a time of loudspeakers, and that may be not quite a norm in Western countries, but certainly in Muslim countries, that is the norm. However, the loudspeaker should be used sparingly. So it should be used to call the adhan. Unfortunately, in some Muslim countries, not only do they call the adhan, but they have the whole prayer on the loudspeaker, quite loud, and often in a manner that is very, I think, disturbing to people who live in the area, to the neighbors. So the deen does not call for us to practice it and to call people to it by way of disturbing them or offending them. So certainly to have some sort of nizam or organization in terms of how we use a loudspeaker is important. And I would say, generally speaking, you're only going to use it for the adhan, not even necessarily for the iqama, and certainly not to broadcast the prayer outside, because people are doing other things. And yes, generally it's better to go to the congregational prayer, but people can be busy doing things that are also important. You know, doctors in their offices and surgeons in their hospital rooms and operating rooms. So there should not be this broad assumption that we disturb everybody's life by calling the prayer from the loudspeaker, the actual prayer itself. Wallahu a'lam. وحكايته لسامع بإبدال الحيعلتين بالحلقلتين ويقول بعد الفراغ اللهم رب هذه الدعوة التامة والصلاة القائمة آتي نبيك محمدا الوسيلة والفضيلة وابعث المقام المحمود الذي وعدته. So he doesn't actually say it in this, but the adhan itself in the Maliki school is, he brings it on later, is muthanna, which means that every thing that is said in the adhan is said twice, including the Allahu Akbar in the beginning. So in the Maliki school, we don't say Allahu Akbar four times. We say it twice. Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. That's the beginning of the adhan. And then the shahadateen comes afterwards. Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah, ashhadu Muhammad Rasulullah. And each one of those is said twice. However, the Maliki school has something called al-tarji'ah. Tarji'ah means that it's said in a lower voice first, the shahadatain, and then in a higher voice afterwards. And this is based upon some of the hadith, namely that the Prophet ﷺ instructed Sayyidina Bilal to do it in this way. And you don't find that in the other schools. So it would be the two takbiratain in the beginning, and then in a lower voice, ashhadu an la ilaha illallah. Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah, ashhadu Muhammad Rasulullah, ashhadu Muhammad Rasulullah. Then in a louder voice, ashhadu an la ilaha illallah, twice. And then the shahada of Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam Rasulullah, twice. So this is called tarji'ah, to repeat it, but in a lower voice and in a louder voice. And then hayya ala salah, hayya ala salah, hayya ala al-falah, hayya ala al-falah. So hayya ala salah means come to prayer. Hayya ala al-falah, comes to success. Then the takbirah twice, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, and then finally ending with La ilaha illallah just once. So he says, حكايته لسامع بإبدال الحيالتين بالحوقلتين. So someone who is listening to the adhan, there's an adab or an etiquette. What's the etiquette? To repeat what you hear from the muadhin as they say it. So when he says Allahu Akbar, you say Allahu Akbar. When he says Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah, you say Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah. Except when you hear Hayya 'ala as-salah wa hayya 'ala al-falah, then you say La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah. Each time you hear it. So that would be four times. Hayya 'ala as-salah, hayya 'ala as-salah, hayya 'ala al-falah, hayya 'ala al-falah. So to hear it, you say La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah. And then تقول بعد الفراغ, after it's finished, the hadith of the Prophet صلى الله عليه وسلم, or the dua that is in the hadith of Prophet صلى الله عليه وسلم, اللهم ربي هذه الدعوة التامة وصلاة القائمة. So you're saying, Ya Allah, who is the Lord of this da'wa التامة, this complete call, this perfect call, وصلاة القائمة, and the impending prayer, آتي نبيك محمدا سيدنا محمد الوسيلة والفضيلة. Give your Prophet, our Sayyid, Muhammad the وسيلة and the فضيلة. Right? Give him the means and the virtue. وَبَعْثُ الْمَقَامِ الْمَحْمُودِ, and give him the maqam al-mahmood, the most praised or the praised station. And this is maqam al-shafa'a, that he will be the intercessor for all of creation on the Day of Judgment. الَّذِي وَعَدْتَهُ, the one that you promised to him. وَفِي صَحِحِ الْإِمَامِ مُسْلِمِ مَنْ قَالَ حِينَ يَسْمَعُ الْمُؤَذِّنِ وَأَنَا أَشْهَدُ أَنْ لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا اللَّهُ وَحْدَهُ لَا شَرِيكَ لَهُ وَأَنَّ مُحَمَّدًا عَبْدُهُ وَرَسُولُهُ رَضِيتُ بِاللَّهِ رَبًّا وبالإسلام دينا وبمحمد صلى الله عليه وسلم رسولا غفر له ذنبه. So the hadith of Muslim also, that whoever hears the muadhin and says the same as he does, and then ends with رَضِيْتُ بِاللَّهِ رَبًّا وَإِسْلَامِ دِينًا مُحَمَّدٍ صَلَّى اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِ وَسَلَّمَ رَسُولًا, that I am pleased with Allah as my Lord and Islam as my Deen and Muhammad صلى الله عليه وسلم as my Messenger, then his sins will be, or her sins will be, forgiven. So as you can see, the adhan is not just an exercise for the muadhin or the people coming to prayer, but even those who merely hear it as well. And it's said that when the adhan is called, the shaitan, Satan, goes to, you know, the furthest place he can get away from that. And this is mentioned also in conjunction with the sujood. So when you're in your sujood, Satan can't really affect you like he usually does, and during the calling of the adhan. Allahu a'lam. Wal iqama سنة لكل فريضة ولو مقضية. So the iqama now is what we said is the impending call to prayer that comes after the adhan. It's a sunnah. For whom? For every fard prayer. For every single person who's going to pray a fard, then you should do the iqama. ولو مقضية, even if it's a makeup prayer, you would still do the iqama. وهي سنة سنة عَيْنٍ لِلْمُنْفَرِدِ, right? And it's an individual sunnah for the individual who's going to pray. وَسُنَّةٌ كِفَايَةٍ لِلْجَمَاعَةِ, but if it's a group that's about to pray, then one of them has to call the iqama, then we call that sunnah kifaya. So just like we have fard kifaya and fard ayn, we also have sunnah ayn, a sunnah that's an, you know, a sunnah or a highly recommended act for the individual. I think I said obligation, I meant to say highly recommended before. And an act that is highly recommended for the group, which means that one of the group has to, should be doing it, or is highly recommended to do it. وَيَحْسُنُ مِنَ الْمَرْأَةِ إِقَامَتُهَا لِنَفْسِهَا سِرًّا, and also women should also be calling the iqama, even though they would do it sirra, in a lower voice, such as she hears herself. وَالْأَذَانُ مَوْقُوفٌ مُثَنَّى, as we said. The adhan is mawquf, so this particular way that I just described earlier, it's mawquf. Mawquf means the Prophet ﷺ specifically designated this way. Why is there a difference between the Maliki school in terms of the takbir in the beginning? He says two and the others say four. Imam Malik says that this is what he found the ulama of Medina doing, and that was the practice of the people of Medina, and so he continued that practice. The other schools understood the hadith to mean something like four rather than two. Wallahu a'lam. So hadith, another hadith of Bilal says there was tarbi'a takbir, that you say takbir four times and didn't have this issue of tarji'a. Wallahu a'lam. So two different hadiths or different narrations of hadith is where the difference of opinion comes in. So whenever we have something like that, then we say both, if they're plausible interpretations, explanations, then whichever one someone wants to do, they're both permissible. But in this case, we say that the madhab of Imam Malik is to say the takbira twice in the beginning. وهي مفردة معربة. What's هي الإقامة. So the iqama is different than the adhan. It has the same words, but you say everything once. So you would say, except for the two takbiras in the beginning, everything is going to come once. Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah, Ashhadu anna Muhammadan Rasulullah, Hayya al-Salah, Hayya al-Falah, Qad iqamat al-Salah, just once, not twice. Other schools do it twice. And then Allahu Akbar, la ilaha illallah. So only the takbiras you're going to do twice, in the beginning, at the end, and then everything else is going to be said once, including Qad iqamat al-Salah for the Maliki iqama. ويستحب الدعاء بعدها ولا يفصل بينها وبين الصلاة وإن طال أعيدت. This part where he says يستحب الدعاء بعدها after the إقامة, that's not what the dear stated. This is from the author of this book, Sheikh Abdul Aziz Muhammad Al Sheikh Mubarak. And generally speaking, what I know from the madhab is we don't really have dua istiftah. Dua istiftah means you don't say a dua after takbirat al-ihram, but you can say something before it. So there's no particular dua that's wedded here that I'm aware of. You can say something like Subhanallah Rabbi al-Azim, Subhanallah Rabbi al-A'la, Subhanallah bihamdi, Subhanallah al-Azim, something like that, before you get into some sort of tasbih, and then the imam will say Allahu Akbar, or you, if you're praying by yourself, you say Allahu Akbar right after the iqama. Also for the iqama, once it is called, no one should begin a new prayer. So if you walk into the masjid and the iqama has been called, don't pray the sunnah. You should join the jama'ah, or if they already started praying, that you should join the jama'ah. There's going to be very slight exceptions to that, but generally speaking, إذا أقيمت الصلاة فلا صلاة ولا كلام. If the iqama comes, then there's not a new prayer that you start, nor should one speak at that particular point to their friend, but join in the prayer once the iqama has been called. So then that brings us into the next section, which we'll start, which is talking about شروط الصلاة. And شروط means condition. There are two types of conditions. We went over this a little bit before. Actually, three types. So there are conditions what are called shurut wujub, conditions of obligation. In other words, if this condition is present, then that would indicate that something is now obligatory upon somebody. Then there's something else called shurut siha, a condition of validity, which means that this condition has to be present for the act to be valid, in other words, to count. Like in terms of the prayer, we said min shurut as-siha at-tahara, right? That one is in a state of ritual purity. If we have that condition, does that guarantee the prayer is valid? No, because there could be other conditions as well. So when you have conditions of validity, it means all of the conditions have to be fulfilled. And the same thing for conditions of obligation. Then there are some conditions that are both condition of an obligation and of validity at the same time. Something like that would be al-aql, to be of sound mind. So to be of sound mind means that now it's obligatory upon you to offer the ritual prayer. And also it's a condition of validity, such as if you don't have a sound mind, if you're unconscious or if you're clinically insane, then the prayer would not be valid from you anyway, were you to do it. Allahu A'lam. So he's going to go into some of these conditions. The first, في شروط الصلاة, he says, طهارة الحدث وقد تقدمت. The first one we already did, because it's the one that usually you have to do the most to actually perform, which is طهارة الحدث, ritual purity. So whether in the form of wudu, whether in the form of tayammum or of ghusl, right? If tayammum, if you don't have access to water or can't use it or it's not available, then you would resort to tayammum, and we already went over that. Wa taharatul khabath. So the other type of purity is physical purity of your place of prayer, of your clothing, and of your body. This is also a condition. وَهِيَ الصَّلَاةُ بِبَدَنٍ طَاهِرٍ وَمَحْمُولٍ طَاهِرٍ وَفِي مَحَلٍ طَاهِرٍ وَهُوَ مَا تَمُسُّهُ أَعْضَاءِ الْمُصَلِّينَ. So طهارة الخبث then is that you enter with no najasa, and we already went over najasa, no impurities upon your body, and upon your clothes, or anything that moves as you move. So anything that, like if you have a backpack or a purse and you're keeping it on and it's moving as you're moving, like if a woman has a backpack and there's a dirty diaper in the backpack and it's moving as she's moving, then that's najasa. So she should not pray with that or remove it. So that's taharat al-mahmul, that's what moves with you. Taharat al-makan, the place you're going to pray, means the place where you're going to touch your body parts. So where you stand, where your knees come down for sujood, and where your hands come down and your head and your forehead and your nose touches the ground, all have to be free of najasa, of impurities. فَإِنْ صَلَّ بِالنَّجَاسَةِ عَامِدًا قَادِرًا بَطَلَتْ وَذِكْرُهَا فِي الصَّلَاةِ مُبْطِلٌ إِنِ اتَّسَعَ الْوَقْتُ وَقَدْرَ عَلَى رَفْعِهَا وَإِنْ لَمْ يَذْكُرْ إِلَّا بَعْدَ أَنْ سَلَّمَ أَوْ عَجَزَ عَنْ رَفْعِهَا أَعَادَهَا نَدْبًا إِذَا قَدَرْ فِي الظُّهْرَيْنِ مَا لَمْ تَصْفَرْ الشَّمْسِ وَفِي الْعَشَائَيْنِ وَالصُّبْحِ مَا لَمْ يَطْلُعُ الْفَجْرِ وَالشَّمْسِ. So, if someone prays with, here it says someone prays with the najasa on them, عَامِدًا قَادِرًا. الْعَامِد وَالْقَادِر, right? So if you have it on you and you're aware of it, and nevertheless you pray with it, بَطَلَتْ الصَّلَةِ, the prayer is invalid. If you're aware of it and you have the ability to remove it. If you don't have the ability to remove it, then that's another story we're going to get to in a second. وَذِكْرُهَا فِي الصَّلَاةِ مُبْطِلٌ إِنِ اتَّسَعَ الْوَقْتُ وَقَدْرَ عَلَى رَفْعِهَا. If you start praying and you weren't aware of it, and then you become aware of it, right? Or you're praying, and you're praying outside, and then a bird comes and kind of, you know, does his business on you. Some people are more prone to that than others. Then, at this point, you're aware that the najasa has come on you. So once the najasa is on you at this point, if there's enough time to leave the prayer, wash it off or change your clothing, and then come back and still have enough time before the prayer time is over, then it becomes obligatory upon you to do that. If you don't do that and you continue to pray, and then you finish the prayer and you didn't do that, then salah batlat. What if you're in the prayer and the bird comes and does his business and you didn't even notice it? You're not even aware, and you left and you finished praying, and then someone points it out to you. Do you have to repeat your prayer? You don't have to repeat it, but it would be desirable to if there's enough time still remaining, as we'll get to in a second. So also, al-qadr ala raf'iha, to have the ability to remove it. So let's say you have no water and you have no change of clothes. Then in this case, removing the najasa is not obligatory upon you, because it's preferred to pray with some najasa on you than to pray with some of your awra not covered, as we'll get to in a second. For a man, however, or a woman, if it's an outer garment and they still have an undergarment that's covering all of their awra, then they can take it off and they can still pray. So removing the najasa doesn't mean you have water necessarily to remove it, but you have whatever means that may be. Whether it's removing the garment and you're still, your awra is covered, then that's considered also removal of the najasa. وَإِنْ لَمْ يَذْكُرْ إِلَّا بَعْدَ أَنْ سَلَّمَ أو عجز عن رفعها أعادها ندبا إذا قدر في الظهرين ما لم تصفر الشمس وفي العشاءين والصبح ما لم يطلع الفجر والشمس. And this is what I just said. So if you don't see it, you're not aware of it until after you say the salam, you've left the prayer, or you didn't have the ability to remove it for whatever reason, أعادها ندبا إذا قدر, then you are to repeat it if you're able to do so, to remove the najasa in the time. Which time? فِي الظُّهْرَيْنِ مَا لَمْ تَصْفَرَ الشَّمْسِ. So for ظُهْرَ الْعَصْرِ, as long as we don't get to al-isfirar, of the Shams. So for Dhuhr, that means we're getting into the Waqt al-Daruri. And for Asr, it's still the Waqt al-Ikhtiyari. وَفِي الْأَشَاءَيْنِ وَالصُّبْحِ مَا لَمْ يَطْلَعُ الْفَجْرِ وَالشَّمْسِ. So for the Isha'ain, Maghrib and Isha, then you are to repeat it up until Fajr. And for the Subh, up until the sun rises, obviously. And that's when the prayer time ends. But if you pray Fajr, for example, you said Salaamu Alaikum, then you went about your business, the sun rose, and then you notice when you're taking off your garment that there's some najasa on it, then there's no repetition for you, because you were not aware of it when it happened. وَمَنْ رَعَفَ فِي الصَّلَاةِ وَظَنَّ إِسْتِغْرَاقَهُ الْوَقْتَ تَمَادَى وَإِلَّا فَإِنْ رَشَحَ فَتَلَهُ بِأَنَامِلِ الْيُسْرَى الْعُلْيَى ثُمَّ فِي الْوُسْطَى فَإِنْ زَادَ فِيهَا عَلَى الدِّرْهَمِ أَوْ قَطَرَ أَوْ سَالَ قَطَعَ وَلَهُ الْبِنَاءُ بِشُرُوطٍ تُطْلَبُ مِنَ الْمُطَوَّلَاتِ. This is a rare mas'ala. He brings it up here, but if someone has a nosebleed in the prayer, that's what raf is, rafa fi salah. وَظَنَّ إِسْتِغْرَاهُ الْوَقْتِ تَمَادَى. If you feel this nosebleed is going to be continuous, so even if you left the prayer, it's not going to stop, then what do you do? If it's going to be continuous, like in other words, throughout the rest of the time period you have to pray, الْإِخْتِيَارِ, of the preferred time, تَمَادَى, you remain in the prayer, don't leave it. Otherwise, فِنْ رَشَحَ فَتَلَهُ بِأَنَامِلِ الْيُسْرَى الْعُلْيَى. Then you stay in the prayer and then you use your left finger to kind of take the blood, you know, enamel it, you know, with your fingertips until it stops. If it doesn't stop then you use the middle fingers. Then if it doesn't stop then you go to the right hand. فِنْ زَادَ فِيهَا عَلَى الدِّرْهَمِ أَوْ قَطَرَ أَوْ سَالَ قَطَعَ. However, if it's so much blood that even doing that doesn't stop, which is what we say, dirham al-baghri, remember when we talked about najasat? So more than like a half dollar size like that, if you were to put it in one place, then in this case, qata, you would cut off the prayer, you'd go wash it, and then come back. وَلَهُ الْبِنَاءُ بِشُرُوطٍ تُطْلَبُ مِنْ الْمُطَوَّلَاتِ. And also, you could actually do that, wash, and come back and rejoin the prayer. And he says there's shurut, there's conditions to do that, but it's going to be in some of the longer books to talk about. So I'm not going to go into it because we're trying to kind of do something that's easy for people to remember. And that is the section for the shurut as-salah in terms of najasa. The next section he's going to talk about Satr al-Awra, or the covering of one's nakedness, and we'll do that too, I think. So Fasl fi Satr al-Awra, which is the covering of one's nakedness. And this actually applies to in the prayer and outside of the prayer. And I'm not aware in the Maliki fiqh books that covering of one's body and the proper covering comes in any other section except right here. So he says, يَجِبُ عَلَى الرَّجُلِ وَالْأَمَةِ سَتْرُ مَا بَيْنَ السُّرَّةِ وَالرُّكْبَةِ بِكَثِيفِ وَتَبْطُلُ صَلَاةُ الرَّجُلِ بِكَشْفِ السَّوْءَتَيْنِ وَالْأَمَةِ بِهِمَا وَبِالْإِلْيَتَيْنِ وَيُعِيدُ الرَّجُلُ فِي الْوَقْتِ لِلْإِلْيَتَيْنِ وَالْأَمَةُ لِلْفَخْذَيْنِ. So, before I read this section, in kind of pre-modern practice of Islam, which it's not an issue anymore, but there were people who were bondsmen or bondmaidens, people who were slaves in society. And the traditional fiqh looks at them in terms of their covering their nakedness differently than they would at someone who's not in a state of bondage. And usually the reason cited is that the nature of them being out and their work and so forth, and even, I would say, most of them were somewhat destitute and didn't have enough clothes. That was kind of a thing for a long time. They are required to cover less of themselves than someone who has the means to and is considered a free person. So that's why he puts a man and an emma, who is a bond woman or a captive woman, in the same category. So he says, يَجِبُ عَلَى الرَّجُلِ وَالْأَمَةِ. So a man and someone who is in a state of bondage, a woman, ستر ما بين السرة والركبة بكثيف. So to cover that which is between the navel and the knees with something that is opaque, not transparent, and also not form-fitting. Though he doesn't say distinctly here, but كثيف is mean that also. واسع enough. ألا يصف ولا يشف. Right? You can't see the body parts underneath. ولا يشف. Right? And it's not transparent. So, you know, I've said this in other settings. I don't think skinny jeans kind of covers that. It's too tight. Yoga pants. And this is considered in the prayer and outside of the prayer. So anything that is going to be form-fitting, such as it doesn't take much of an imagination to see what's going on there, then this would be improper for a Muslim to wear, whether in the prayer or outside of the prayer, whether man or whether woman. So for a man, the minimum is going to be from the navel to the knees. We don't have slave women anymore, so this doesn't apply. When we get to the women's section, we'll see what that is. وَتَبْطُلُ الصَّلَاةُ الرَّجْلِ بِكَشْفِ السَّوْءَتَيْنِ. The Malikiya, however, they divided awra into kind of two broad categories. What's called al-ghalidh wal-khafif. So the must-be-covered awra, such as that if it becomes uncovered during a prayer, it invalidates the prayer, he calls as-saw'atayn, which is basically the rear and front private parts. That's the minimum. That doesn't mean you go into the prayer like that. I don't want people going to the masjid tomorrow with speedos and said it's okay because the Maliki fiqh book said it's okay. That's not what he's saying. He's saying that if incidentally it becomes uncovered and you're in the prayer is not invalidated by that. But he's going to mention later, I believe, that you should do it over. You're out for the waqt. Lil khafif. But this is, we're talking about il ghalidh, which is the minimally required awra to be covered. وَيَجِبُ عَلَى الْحُرَّةِ سَتْرُ جَمِيعَ بَدِنِيهَا وَشَعْرِهَا إِلَّا الْوَجَهِ وَالْكَفَّيْنِ وَبُطُونَ الْقَدَمَيْنِ. And as for a woman, here he says الْحُرَّة, but الْحُرَّة means women today who are not in a state of bondage. سَتْرُ جَمِيعَ بَدِنِيهَا, all of her body and her hair, إِلَّا الْوَجَهِ, except for the face, وَالْكَفَّيْنِ, and the hands, like the wrists down, وبطون القدمين, and the soles of the feet, assuming that, you know, you can't see the soles of the feet because they're standing on them. وتبطل صلاتها بكشف ما بين ركبتيها إلى صدرها. So العورة المغلظة, for the woman, however, like the man, we said the front and rear private areas, the minimum basic. For the woman, the minimum basic awra that doesn't invalidate the prayer, still valid, but nevertheless she should be covering the rest of her body, is that which is between her chest to her knees. So when does that become like an issue? If a woman prays, for example, and she's wearing hijab and everything, and she prays and says, assalamu alaikum, she goes home, she prayed Dhuhr, Maghrib is coming already, she already prayed Asr. And as she's getting in her house and she looks in the mirror, she knows that a lock of hair is coming out from the back of her hijab. Does she have to redo all those prayers? No, she does not. Because in the Maliki school, that's not from what we call al-awra al-mughallada. It's from al-awra al-mukhaffafa. Al-awra al-mukhaffafa, which is the lighter awra. It's haram to show it. Let's be clear about that. However, if during the course of the prayer, it becomes uncovered for whatever reason and you're not aware of it, it does not nullify or invalidate your prayer. Your prayer is still valid. وَتُعِيدُ لِغَيْرِ ذَلِكَ فِي الْوَقْتِ. And this is what we just said. So, anything then that is outside of that then has to be repeated in time. So the minimum for the man, wherever he goes, is from السُرَّة لِلْرُكْبَةِ. So from the navel to the knees. So the navel is included. Some of the ulama say the navel is not included. The Maliki school says the navel is included and then the knees are not included. So up to, down to the knees. The Shafi'i school does the opposite. That the navel is not technically in the awra, but the knees are in the awra. So the safer thing is to cover both. When possible. Or not when possible, but preferably. Does that mean that men should go outside in the street even in the summer bare-chested, and because it's technically not from their awrah? No, because also this is a book of legalisms, of what's, you know, what invalidates, what's valid, what's halal, what's haram. But then we have something called adab, and what's proper and what's appropriate and what's etiquette. So it's not from etiquette to go outside bare-chested, just walking around. If they're in a swimming pool, they're at a lake, that's something else. But generally speaking, they should not enter the prayer with their shoulders uncovered, and they should preferably have something that covers both shoulders at the very minimum. Short sleeves, long sleeves, that's a different issue. But at the very minimum, not to have something where shoulders are uncovered or where the chest is uncovered. This is for a man. And also not to have anything too form-fitting. So the type of clothing that many people wear today, both men and women, even though they may be wearing hijab, or he may have everything from his navel to his knees covered, but it's too tight, and body parts can be seen underneath. So that's not a proper covering of the awrah, even though it's fashionable. However, lowering of the gaze, which is not specifically mentioned here, but it's important. One should be doing that regardless of what the member of the opposite sex is wearing. So even if she's wearing something form-fitting, it is not a license for a man to look at her lustfully and lower the gaze. Still, the onus is upon the person, not upon the person who is not dressed in an appropriate manner. Them not being dressed in an appropriate manner is kind of outside of that importance. It doesn't remove the obligation from either party, from either member of the opposite sex, to not look lustfully at another member of the opposite sex. وَمَنْ عِنْدَهُ ثَوْبٌ حَرِيرٌ وَثَوْبٌ مُتَنَجِّسٌ يُقَدِّمُ الْحَرِيرُ فَإِنْ لَمْ يَجِدْ إِلَّا الْمُتَنَجِّسَ وَلَمْ يَقْدِرْ عَلَى غَسْلِ صَلَّى بِهِ. So here he brings like a scenario that not very likely to happen, but just in case. If you only have clothing, either it's silk, so a man can't wear 100% silk, but let's say, for argument's sake, you have silk, and you have thawb mutanajjis, you have clothing that but has najasa on it, which one do you choose? They're both not proper, but you need to cover your awrah. He says, يُقَدِّمُ الْحَرِيرِ. The silk is preferred over the one that is sullied with something that is najasa. فَإِلَّمْ يَجِدْ إِلَّا الْمُتَنَجِّسَ وَلِمَقْلَ الْغَسْلِ صَلَّى بِهِ. However, if he only has clothing that's mutanajjis, that is nullified with some sort of najasa, then he is to pray with that. As opposed to what? As opposed to praying naked. So praying with something with najasa on it is better than praying with no clothing at all. Wallahu ta'ala a'la wa a'lam. So we're going to stop here, inshallah, for this session. Next time we'll look at another shart siha, condition of validity of the prayer, and that's namely istiqbal al-qibla, or facing the Mecca prayer direction when you are praying. Alhamdulillah, Rabbil Alameen.